Today's authors posit we are recurring patterns of mind-body energy, chemistry, perception, and behavior. I'll throw in biology as well. James Fadiman and Jordan Gruber explore this from multiple perspectives throughout history in their co-written book, Your Symphony of Selves. This is Robin with Tributaries. Jim and Jordan, thank you for being with us here. And your book, Your Symphony of Selves, speaks to the eventual promise of the collective, yet you're starting with the individual.
Right. And I'm not sure how much the collective needs help at the moment, but we know the individual does.
Yeah, I think the collective will follow suit. That's my thinking anyway. So with your Symphony of Selves, who did you write this book for?
Why don't we both take a crack at that one, because it's such a tricky and incredibly astute question.
Okay.
Which is, we wrote this book for people who are interested in themselves and wondering why things are not a little easier for them, as well as people in relationships who are wondering why the person they're in relationship with isn't more consistent. So we're limiting it to that group.
Okay, which is everyone on the planet, maybe?
as far as we can tell, that's our position. Jordan?
So this is Jordan, and for me, originally I was brought in to help Jim, who had gone on this expedition through his own mind and experience, and in this island of reality that he was experiencing, it was obvious to him that healthy selves was the way actually most people were, and yet it was never ever talked about. So way back in around 1990, he gave a talk on this subject, and that was the first time I had ever laid eyes on Jim Fadiman. And then it didn't become a thing between us for a long time, but Jim continued to work on it. And when I got brought into the project 5 or 6 years ago, it became clear that this is really important and really revelatory information. And even though it's not new information, it's the way psychology was in 1895. And a lot of people, like internal family systems and voice dialogue and psychosynthesis, have already looked at this. For most people, taking the reality that they actually have different selves that are real, that are unique, that have innate value, that often have their own agendas and even their own entelechy, the entelechy of an acorn is to become an oak. Once you realize you're actually built that way, all you have to do is look at that a little bit, and everything in your life can begin to recontextualize in a way that's easier and more effective. So I guess I'm a convert, not that we have a theory, because we don't have a theory. We're just going, wow, this is actually how it is and has been this way, and nobody ever talks about it except in very pathological situations like Sybil.
Were you going to say something, Jim?
Well, what I was saying is that this is a book for people who want to understand the way the world actually works. So it just makes more sense for people. We don't have people that say, this is a complete revelation. We instead have people that say, oh, here's a book that says to me what I actually realize is true. I've just never quite had the context, quite had the words to say it. So it's a book that says, I'm seen. Yes, this is how it is. That's why we don't have a theory. You don't need a theory if you have facts.
Uh-oh. Can of worms. But let me ask you this. Selves, how does it differ from states of mind? In a way, it kind of feels 90s into the 2000s, where it seems this culture, even though we are asking those existential questions that have been asked through the ages, it's very me-oriented. Yes or no?
How could you say that's a yes or no question? That's like saying, what is truth, yes or no? It's coming back into the culture, the awareness of selves, which is why the book has examples from popular culture, from unpopular culture, from neuroscience, from philosophy, from therapeutic systems, all of which acknowledge in one way or another that they're ourselves. It's not a secret, but we have an overriding kind of system that says there has to be just one self. It just has to be, even if it isn't true. It's the way it is.
I'm still questioning if it's considered a self or a state of mind. Maybe you both or one of you could share an example of how one moves from oneself into another and how you can help yourself so we can move into those seamless transitions without coming from a huge reaction.
Exactly.
Let me give you a little example that's in the book.
Great.
In a pathway in my backyard, there's a wisteria that grows in the way and was putting out this flower, and the normal me would just whip out my pocket knife and cut it off because it's blocking the corridor, and there's a corridor rule. And one day I had the thought, it was early morning, the birds were singing, I thought, what if I was in that part of me that loves smelling and loves flowers, and it doesn't matter at all? And I stopped, and I smelled it, and I walked around it, and I was so much happier that I didn't need to cut that. That's a different part of me that's not usually present. It was very delightful. And I think you're asking really good questions about, is it states of mind? So, you know, the book is at a lot of levels, from cartoons all the way to a detailed appendix on dissociation. And we talk a lot about self-states, and we work from Charles Tart's definition, and we say it doesn't really matter what you call them, that we have 70 terms, but it's the reality of knowing that you have different attractive basins of performance and behavior and how people interact with you, and you come back to them time and time again. We had a secretary at the publisher talking to us about this, and she said, so when I go pick up my kids in daycare, and I'm like much happier and informal and in different clothes, and I'm really kind of a different person in that context. And we said, yeah, exactly. You may be in a better or worse mood, but you're in that part of who you are. And so we're saying that once you get that this is really real, that you have selves, then you go, wow, I can begin to work with that. And there's a lot of different ways that people have begun to work with it, but it's coming back to the kind of existential reality that despite what the core of Western philosophy and religion say, we have multiple selves. It's just how life actually is.
Well, since you brought up religion, I would like to ask from a spiritual standpoint. I'm kind of a person who would maybe prefer most of the time to finish each sentence with the word is. In the definition and the breakdown, we're kind of destroying that initial, this is who we are. How do you delineate a healthy self from a not healthy self? Why break that down?
Well, the difference between a healthy self and an unhealthy self is no different from a healthy person and an unhealthy person. And the word unhealthy in the mental health world means that you don't make appropriate decisions that serve you. You make decisions that actually make your life worse. And all of us have aspects of ourselves that aren't good for the rest of us. There's a part of us that says, I want to stay up all night and dance. And another part says, but you still have to go to work in the morning, and if you stay up all night and dance, your work is going to be terrible. And the dancer says, that's your problem. And sometimes we stop dancing, and sometimes we continue to dance. It's not a distinction between healthy and unhealthy. What it is, and it's a term we use a lot, it's, are you in the appropriate self for what you're doing? Meaning, if you're very intense at work, you really don't want to be that person when you're with your children. And vice versa, you don't want to be the kind of silly, playful person you are as a parent when you're in an international sales meeting. And those are not moods. Those are not a feeling states. Those are actually a whole complicated set of beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors that we call a self.
Do you think this is important now because you're seeing, or perhaps we are all experiencing, having to be many more selves than perhaps people were 100 years ago?
Yep. Exactly.
Didn't have to think about that one, did you?
No, because technology has created new opportunities for selves that we all are kind of caught with. And we all know that we see people looking at their phones when they should rather be with other people, especially when they're with their children. That never happened before, okay?
Yes.
No 15th century mom had the problem of media distraction.
could I take us back 1 second to
Please.
The definition of healthy and unhealthy cells?
Sure.
A really important distinction at the basis of what we're talking about is that having more than one self does not make you unhealthy, is not a mental pathology. Under traditional psychology, anytime you move from one self to another self, you're committing an act of mental pathology that has been technically described as dissociation. What we're saying is the exact opposite. Mental health is being in the right mind at the right time. That learning to shift and work with yourselves, and we provide a lot of different models and metaphors for that, is actually one of the major keys to being healthy and happy. The most cohesive people, those people, consciously or unconsciously, have already learned to orchestrate their own symphony of selves so their life is successful. So we're coming at this at a very fundamental level in terms of how psychology thinks about the human being. It's not new. Plato had bits of it, and William James had nearly all of it 130 years ago.
Of course, and leave it to the poets and the artists and the spiritually advanced folks to know that. Can we basically say it means being in the moment?
Oh, absolutely. And healthy is being in the right self at the right moment.
Do you offer steps into discovering that?
The curious thing is the book itself is that step. See, I've written a self-help book a long time ago on affirmations, and like all self-help books, it says, now you've read this book, here's a whole list of things you need to do. Kind of like cookbooks don't ever make you less hungry because you have to then go out and cook. What we found, what people say in reading the book, just reading the first few chapters, they begin to shift without effort. And that turns out to be a kind of remarkable in its own right. Then in the last few chapters of the book, we not only describe lots of systems that do exist to help people make successful, better use of themselves, but we also have a lot of individual practices that people can do if they wish.
And stories.
And always stories.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the book that's fun, Robin, is from the title to the cartoons to the easy stuff in the first chapters, all the way through the technical reviews of psychology and philosophy and neuroscience and postmodernism and Buddhism, and then into kind of looking at the bigger societal implications, there's lots of different levels of impact the book can have. And we even have a chart in chapter 2 that said, here are the benefits of this book. If you've gotten this far, this book has, Ken Wilber used to use the word psychoactive. His materials were psychoactive. This book has psychoactively opened you up to considering the seductive invitation that if you question the single self assumption, things might be a lot better for you.
Okay, well, my question is, it never dawned on me that anybody was into a single self.
I know, because we have this problem, which is, at one level, this is as obvious as the fact that you have fingers and a thumb, which is quite different than the other fingers. You don't need to kind of have a theory of fingers. On the other side, we have a huge amount of the culture that says you only have a single self. There is a goal in your life to be a unified self. If you have more than one self, you can learn to fuse them together. So there's a lot in the culture and a lot of kind of common talk about I'm a single unified person, even if that word unity turns out not to be true.
And a place where you see this a lot is in, I mean, I've taken a lot of workshops and spiritual courses and things like that in my life, and Jim has given tons of them. And in the end, most systems try to get you to evoke or create or get in touch with it or find a way to always know how to contact your high self, your super self, your single super self. And we're going, that may be true and it may be possible, but that's not at the pragmatic level of you and everyone else you know has selves that we're talking about.
Well, I don't know. Isn't it worth the journey heading toward that unity of all?
There is a term, and it's called a differentiated unity. And that's the goal, which is all of you operates in an optimal way all of the time.
Right.
Now, that also means sometimes you need to use anger. Sometimes you must be loving. sometimes you must be forgiving, other times you should be assertive, and you have to then have a whole self that goes along with making that work. So if I'm in a meeting, and I was in a meeting once with the former head of the National Rifle Association, it was clear that unless I became my absolute toughest self, that the negotiation we were in was going to go nowhere. And so I needed to have access to a very unused part of myself, because I'm a new age sweetie face. But it worked very well, and he decided I was a very likable person and that we could work together. That wasn't a mood. That was my differentiated unity, picking the right mind at the right time.
Yes, totally understood. Now, Jim, I know you are a very well-researched proponent of microdosing with psychedelics.
Right.
And the consciousness that I believe, I know, it
yes,
is what you're talking about, isn't it? Yes.
Well, microdosing simply makes the whole system run better, physical, mental system run better. High-dose psychedelics, that's a different question.
That's for certain cells.
It goes beyond personality.
Right. For instance, if someone's doing a lot of work with trauma,
right,
eventually their path will meet with the symphony of selves path.
Right.
Wouldn't you say?
Well, I watched a video of one of the post-traumatic stress people who was on a strong dose of MDMA, and he starts by saying, there's a part of me I hate. And as you watch, and this is slices over an eight-hour therapy session, he begins to acknowledge that that part of him is real, that part of him has its own needs, and that that part of him can be helped. He then begins to befriend that part, and by the end of the sequence, what you're seeing is someone who, in a sense, is holding hands, you know, is one of his denied selves,
mm-hmm.
and basically saying, I want to help you not be terrified of you. But he's clear that it's another self of his own.
Mm-hmm.
And while that MDMA may facilitate that and make it happen more quickly, the same sort of process can happen without it when people start healing.
Of course, yes. Can you share perhaps another story of someone who's looking at separate selves and recovering a better life, a better lifestyle?
Well, very simply, almost everyone who goes to an AA meeting is doing that. They are bringing the self that feels that drinking is a necessity to a meeting of other people who have had the same belief and overcome it. And their goal is to have the alcoholic self give way to the non-alcoholic self, so that when alcohol comes up, the needy alcoholic is no longer so desperate. And I remember a wonderful friend who said, I was an alcoholic for many years, and I loved the bar scene, and I loved the talk, and I loved the conversation. And what he did is he would run the open bars at conferences because he just liked being around all of it except the drinking.
Definitely.
I have a story.
Okay.
I had a bike accident. I went head over heels, and for 2.5 years I didn't get on a bicycle. And then I heard a part of me internally say, dude, we've been riding bikes since we were 5. You need to get a new bike and get on. And the second I got on that new bike, I was so happy and so thrilled that I had listened to myself. And I'm riding every day now. And an important point of our book is that different selves aren't called into being only by traumatic, violent, horrible experiences when you're young. Many of your selves are born in moments of deep pleasure and even ordinary self-dissolution and happiness. I have a self that was born in the ocean when I was 4 years old because we went to the beach every day. And I realized that in my mid-40s, I had an opportunity to be in a Chesapeake Bay for 3 hours just trolling about on an inner tube at 2.5 feet of water. And I went right back. I thought, wow, that's when this part of me really emerged. So I think we all can do this all the time, and you can pull out selves from the past that were beneficial or even create new ones to deal with what you need to deal with now.
Most of us also know that when we're in love with someone, we become a nicer person. our most loving self comes forward. Many people say that the act of being in love doesn't actually need the beloved nearby. It's an inner shift where you get into that space in yourself. It gives you contentment and pleasure and excitement.
Yes, yes. Now, I did some work years ago as an unlicensed psychologist, so to speak. I'm going to use the word classic psychology, and I guess I don't really know what classic psychology is. However, I'm going to say it anyway.
Well, then you probably did very good work.
I did. Is classic psychology out the window? And as I mentioned, I'm not even sure what I mean by classic, but diagnosing pharmaceutical drugs is rampant. And I apologize if this isn't an appropriate question for what you both are doing, because obviously this is not what you're doing. But I want to help whoever's listening, perhaps, to be able to move beyond that mindset.
Sure. Well, a tiny bit of academic, which is, I have a textbook out called Theories of Personality. It's a theories of personality book. It's called Personality and Personal Growth. The notion is that when you read a bunch of different theories of personality, you end up liking one more than another, and you make use of it and so forth. I do know a lot about conventional psychology, and conventional psychology is all about improving any given self, and all of it could be quite useful, different theories, different ways of going at it, different practices, etc. What conventional psychology has missed, or has forgotten, really, as we found out, has forgotten, is that the goal of individual improvement is self by self. And that what people say is, you know, when I really want to relax, I'll go in the garden. And what they're saying is the self that they are in the garden is one that is deeply relaxed. And someone else says, when I need to meet a deadline, somehow I can stay up all night and I'm focused. Now, that isn't the same self that we meet in the garden. And that self that stays up all night for an all-nighter has different needs and can improve in different ways. We are not one size fits all. We are many sizes with many fittings depending on the situation. So what we're saying when we say the right mind at the right time, we're talking reality. We're not talking theory.
That's it in a nutshell, isn't it? We need to be in the situation we're in, and the presence will lead us, hopefully, into ourselves even deeper.
Especially if we're doing stuff like centering and being aware of center and meditating and whatever practice you like. I mean, there's no question that you can evoke inner harmony and a more cohesive presence and have all yourselves work better by having an intention to do that. And that's really where the book just comes in. Once people get that their selves aren't just moods, aren't just slightly different ways of that they're being, but they tend to actually distinct different ways of being, then they can learn to integrate them.
And people, when they make a shift, it can be a life-changing shift within a moment. I'm thinking, when I was teaching affirmations, I learned a lot about a couple of thousand lives. And one of the things that came up was the idea of stopping smoking. And there's a lot of programs out there to help you stop smoking. But what I found is that what people said is at some point, I looked at the cigarette pack and I picked it up and I walked to the wastebasket and I threw it in, and I've never had a cigarette since. No withdrawal, no hassle. They just realized that they needed to switch into a self that didn't smoke.
So that's a powerful realization.
Yeah.
Right?
To realize you have that self allows you to both let go of an addiction and also to not get mad at yourself that part of you misses it.
Right. That's the other piece. You can't be judging yourself on this path.
You do judge yourself, but you're much nicer. When your children misbehave, you don't say, okay, pack up your toys, you're out of here. But you don't do that because the part of you that knows what's appropriate is in control. And when you read stories of parents who do terrible things to their children, that's a part of them. It's not all of them.
No, we know that obviously it is not. And that's the real beautiful piece of all of this, I would have to say.
Absolutely.
That's a moment right there. We have to just...
we take
yes,
a pause on that.
Yes, exactly. The final section in your Symphony of Selves explores dissociation, and what was the key importance of that?
So dissociation, people have a lot of energy on it. More than once I've spoken to someone and told them about the book, and they said, hey, my brother or nephew dissociated, it was terrible, and you're advocating it. And so what we do is we take a step back, and we look at the origins of the term in the appendix. And earlier we've been building up to the conclusion that the problem with the term dissociation, not only that it doesn't mean anything, but that it's based on a faulty premise. The premise is that if you move from one self to another, even if you are gracefully shifting on purpose, then you have gone from one self-state to another, and you've committed an act of mental pathology. So we're saying the exact opposite. Mental health is knowing how to shift. So the word dissociation itself, and all of the definitions built up on top of it, and the fact that ultimately it's part of the system for hospitals and doctors getting paid, it doesn't help. And so we replace dissociation with cohesion. You could build a theory of psychology based on dissociation from the ground up that was positive. So the more congruent, coherent, and compassionate someone is, the more cohesive they are, and the better their lives are and the lives of the people in their lives. There isn't even a consistent definition. So
not even that. There are several psychological instruments that measure it that don't overlap.
Yeah, the definitions are incoherent.
It's a kind of a buffet term, which is it has a lot of possibilities. People take the ones they want.
Then what about with true diagnoses of schizophrenias or multiple personalities? When is it dangerous to self or others to play around with multiple selves from that standpoint?
Well, one of the things that I learned when I was being trained to be a therapist, and actually my professor was a psychoanalyst, he said never use a diagnostic label.
Bravo.
On any patient.
Yes.
Ever.
Perfect.
Okay? And I thought, woo, where did that come from?
Yeah, you're my guy.
And,
right?
And what I found is one of the problems is that the diagnostic labels are mostly sloppy. There's a strange phenomenon, happens nowhere else in what's called medicine, is every 4 or 5 years, a bunch of experts get together and they redefine all kinds of mental illnesses. They just change the terms and they change what it takes and they change how it should be treated. And I thought, nobody does that with appendicitis. They don't redefine it. Okay? And so when people say that the problem with psychiatry is that it isn't about anything that you can measure, that's one of the problems. So we avoid labels and we recommend avoiding labels. And when people are mentally ill, it means they don't function right. And what we're finding, unfortunately, more and more in older people, is a huge amount of what is called mental illness is actually multiple medication side effects. And there's a fascinating book about holistic medicine, and she was running a home where you went when the hospital tossed you out and you still couldn't function. And it's called Slow Medicine. And what she found with her older patients referred to her from perfectly good hospitals is she was able usually to reduce the number of medications they were on by 75%.
So let me give a little bit more nuance to that response, because you did ask an important question. All the time we hear people asking us about either bipolar or schizophrenia or what about true multiplicity. And again, we say, well, we're presenting a different way of looking at things. The term schizophrenia isn't really what we're talking about. Traditionally, the term would be multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder. But again, for those, we think that's a little bit backwards. The fact that you have selves doesn't make you mentally ill. And with schizophrenia, we quote our old friend Ken Wilber and point out that that's a different thing. That's like a systems meltdown. So if people want to kind of combine everything and throw a lot of terms all at once, and we're just saying, let's slow down and start by looking at it a little bit differently.
So this isn't a book about anyone's pathology. It's a book about everyone else. And even the healthiest parts of people with pathology. And I'm remembering a friend of mine who was hemorrhaging, and she also had a really phobia or hatred about going to doctors. And so she was on the phone to me, weeping, in pain, frightened. And then there was this little pause, and another voice said, "I'll really be all right." And then the other voice took over again. And what I learned later is she went to a physician and got treated and fine. But it was those two voices that was one of the clues for what we're talking about. It was surprising to me when she called so totally freaked out. It was not the way I would know her.
Right.
And so when this other voice came through, I thought, okay, she'll take care of it.
Yeah. Jordan, you used the word permission, I believe, a couple moments ago, and I would just like perhaps to close with both of you speaking about that permission and maybe go back in time. Was there a time in either ancient cultures or perhaps earlier in our culture where we did have permission to be more of who we are and be more inclusive of who we are?
The book talks about the Egyptian system, for example, and the Hmong people who believe you have different selves and aren't coherent and healthy unless they're all in your body and working together. Certainly some of the shamanic traditions, and you see multiplicity in Hinduism too. And so we talk about, did people basically project that into their gods because that's the way we already are?
Right. It's something, so maybe it wasn't even mentioned because this is what's happening, folks.
Well, if you're in a civilization that accepts it, you mention it, but it's not a big deal. Just as I say, you know, my right hand and my left hand have a different level of strength. But I can't remember ever being asked about that.
Exactly.
Well, you know, in the Hindu system, people do consciously invoke aspects of different deities at different times of the years and different cycles with different rituals and herbs and offerings and such. So there are people who have realized that there are different parts of reality and try to step into them.
What we found is that Western medicine and Western science makes one fundamental error, which is it says this covers everything. And we've learned that any system that says it covers everything, we're already suspicious. Okay? And one of the things we know that Western medicine decided wasn't there was spiritual experience. And, of course, the problem is almost every human being on the planet has had some kind of spiritual experience. So we all end up with this immediate awareness of a distrust of the limitations of science. And when you get down to psychology, as I've said now and then, it's even worse. So we're aware that it is normal to look at selves. It's becoming more normal to mention it, and it is easier on people who do.
And that's, for example, why it's so popular in Silicon Valley consulting. They call it parts work, and it's very effective, and lots of coaches are doing it. Or we can go back to Carl Jung. Carl Jung actually wrote his medical dissertation on his cousin's case of multiple personality. And then he was influenced by Charcot and Jung one way or another. And in the end, he talks about autonomous complexes and archetypes. And we relate to how both of those relate to people's selves.
Jordan, hearing you speak about the many deities and they're called upon at different times, it would be interesting to kind of look at the culture or the society that was into the one God as opposed to those into the many deities and where that self and selves, where they fit in there. But anyway, that was just something that went through my mind.
We can be very brief because if you look at the religions that have one God, let's talk about Christianity, which is better known. There's a lot of saints and they have very specific jobs. So that if you pray to the saint for this and pray to the saint for that, you also have 9 levels of angels. For a one-God system, it's very busy up there.
Well, yeah, I mean, from where I'm coming from, yes, but when you pray to this saint or that, are you really praying? I think if you're praying, you're just really sitting and listening for the one bit of information. So it's up for debate and discussion.
No, I'm on your side, but I'm aware that the reason there are saints is that people wanted something that felt more like their inner selves.
And look at what happened in Egypt the first time they tried to enforce the one God thing. It went very poorly. It had to be completely reversed 100 years later. That dynasty fell. It did not work. People did not want just one God.
It didn't make sense to them that there was one God, because that isn't the way they felt about themselves.
Right. Well, I didn't know this would be a great history lesson as well. Thank you for that. You know, I have to say this. When I first started reading your book, I thought, now, who is this book written for? And a part of me felt like it was mandatory reading for someone who was going to start going to see a therapist, so they would have a weapon defense.
Well, I'm delighted you bring it up, because one of our early fans, who's a very successful therapist, 35 years of practice, he says, I now am asking patients, before they start with me, to read this book. He says it just makes therapy go so much easier.
All right. Faster. Wonderful.
So you nailed it exactly.
Well, great. Well, what a pleasure to speak and to get to know both of you a little bit, Jim Fadiman and Jordan Gruber, and your book, Your Symphony of Selves, which is support. It's a huge, grand support of who we are.
Thank you so much.
As you may already know, for any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes and most likely your favorite podcast place. If not, let us know, please. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.